I'm happy now to welcome to the program Caroline Silby. She is a sports psychologist. She's author of the book Games Girls Play, Understanding and Guiding Young Female Athletes. And she will be speaking at the Quinceañera Tea, celebrating art and leadership program for girls at Suite 15 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex on Sunday, June 17th at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you were a member of the national figure skating team, a lifelong athlete. You started your athletic training at the age of 6. What was that like for you? Did you know at that early age that you wanted to be an athlete?
No, not initially, but pretty early on as I had kind of started to progress in the sport and felt like I was getting better and better at it, I definitely got hooked. But initially it was pretty much because there was a rink right around the corner from us, and my sister did it, which is how a lot of people end up starting in individual sports. But it was a terrific journey, and sport really has been a consistent theme throughout my life.
What do parents need to know when getting their children into sports? For example, team sports like soccer or individual sports like skating?
Well, there are certainly differences and different benefits that sometimes kids acquire in each sport. But early on, really, kids just want to be moving their bodies in as many different ways as possible. So finding activities that allow them the opportunity to do that, and to find activity leaders or coaches, if you're in an organized sport, you know, that really are willing to share in that fun, to provide the fun and then share in the fun with the kids, is really kind of primarily what you're looking for in those early stages. Most kids want to start participating in sports because of social reasons. They find it fun to be with their friends, and you really want to encourage that piece of it early on.
How do you know when, for example, their school program isn't enough and when they should go outside of the school and get a coach and things like that?
Yeah, it's an excellent question as to kind of what is the right timing and what is the right fit of a program for any individual child or athlete. And I think there's a lot of factors that go into kind of emotional readiness for kind of a more intensive, higher level program or even individual coaching. And so you kind of have to be able to know your child and know what your child is ready for and not just look at physical capability. So, for instance, a lot of the athletes I work with, their physical capability is actually far ahead of their confidence. And we're trying to work to help their confidence catch up to actually their physical ability. And so sometimes if you put your child into a program where physical ability is excelling, but satisfaction is low and enjoyment is low and stress levels are high, you're going to see them burn out fairly early, and they're going to start saying to you, it's not fun, and I don't want to do it anymore. So looking at all factors, environmental, individual personality characteristics of your child, and then also just family practicalities, you know, what you as a family are willing to do in terms of supporting your child's passion in sport.
I think passion is really the operative word, because a person who really wants to be an athlete is going to focus on that and put a lot of their life energy into that, whereas a person who wants to, maybe they don't know what they want to be, but they're pretty sure it's not an athlete, or maybe they want to be a musician or an artist or something else, then sports take on a really different role in their lives.
Yes, certainly the kids that feel passionate about it are the ones that are going to be putting much more of their time, energy, focus into their activities. But also sport can be used to kind of help kids determine their passion, because when you're using an activity like sport or the arts, and you're pulling out the life lessons for them and teaching them about persistence and focus and emotional management and self-motivation. And so when you're encouraging kids to really bring their best self to whatever endeavor it is that they're doing, they often will end up finding their passion, because what they're starting to understand is, whatever I do, these are the parts of myself and kind of my signature strengths that I can use to then become good at whatever activity I seem to gravitate towards.
A lot of problems that athletes face, and you write about this in your book, are mental and psychological rather than about their physical training. What are some examples of this that you see in teenage girls?
Well, I would say probably about 90% of the athletes that are coming to see me are seeing some kind of gap between what they're capable of doing and what they're able to physically produce on a daily basis. And then what they actually do in a critical moment of performance or in a competitive situation. So much of what I'm really trying to help athletes learn how to do is how to perform their best when it counts the most for them, and give them strategies and tools to then deal with some of the anxiety and nervousness that they may start to feel about performing, especially as they get to higher levels and the expectations continue to be placed upon them, or they place them upon themselves. The interesting thing with adolescent girls is that as expectations for performance and goal attainment increase and rise, it's usually at the exact moment when their confidence is going down. So adolescent girls show significant decreases in confidence, and some studies have cited up to about 30%. And so those two things, there's a collision between the increased expectations and the decrease in confidence. And so we're really working in those time frames to manage expectations appropriately and also give them the tools and strategies to build their self-confidence and to take as many of the life lessons that they can from their sport involvement.
The way you just expressed it, it's as if the decline in confidence is a normal part of female development. What is that true, or what's that all about?
It is. Unfortunately, men and women do experience adolescence differently. And unfortunately, for girls, there are these time periods where they internalize their perceived failures, or when they miss expectations, and they internalize that. And as along with internalizing those failures, they tend to lose interest in activities that they once felt challenged by, and they seek to meet and gain the approval of others. And so sometimes you'll see it that girls won't question authority even when they feel those authority people in positions of authority are incorrect. And so very often they lose their voice during adolescence. And so part of the whole initiative that we're talking about at the Georgia O'Keeffe T, I'll be on Monday the 18th, I'll be actually working with the interns, and part of that is that program is to use the arts to help girls find their voice and express themselves, and to have the ability to learn how to express themselves, but also in clear and appropriate ways.
It does seem very odd. I mean, I remember I read Carol Gilligan's book in a different voice when it came out. It talked about this whole thing that you're talking about, and I've been thinking about it ever since, which is over 20 years since that book came out.
Right.
And it's still mysterious to me. I mean, either it has something to do with massive flooding of estrogen coming into your body, or else there's something horribly wrong with our society.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. What the research is showing is, it's both. And girls, are conditioned and reinforced to be pleasers in a lot of ways, and to meet the approval of others, and they certainly are reinforced for that. But, the genetics also plays a huge part in all of this. And I think sport has played a very large role in helping change that and allow women to have forums to have their voice heard and to feel comfortable knowing that their opinions are worthy of being heard and are valid. And if you look at one of the new studies that came out showed that the states that had the greatest increase or greatest growth in female sports participation, which happened to be North Dakota and Nebraska, those states also saw the greatest growth in women's workforce participation in the 1980s and the 90s. And if you looked at it the other way, the states that required the least growth in female sports, and those were North Carolina and Mississippi, saw the smallest gains in women's workforce participation. So it was really, really powerful data. Because, in other words, demographics, attitudes, and employment opportunities might vary from state to state, but the growth of the female workforce in a particular state almost always mirrored the sports opportunities afforded to girls in that state. And it was a correlation that played out again and again across the country. And so,
very interesting.
Yes, it's very powerful data. And my guess is, although they don't have as powerful data yet for the arts, I think arts provides the same opportunity. Where I think sports has kind of surged ahead is that as there was this increase in participation in women playing sports, we started to see that there were unique issues that women were facing, and we started to address those issues. And sports psychology is now really an integral part of sport, especially individual sports, but also team sports now, really at all levels. So when I look at my own practice, you know, just this month I got 3 calls for 9-year-olds. And not because parents wanted the 9-year-olds to be the next Olympic champion, but because they wanted them to really benefit from this experience and learn the life skills that are going to be the real value of their participation in sport long term. So I think that art has the same capacity. We can teach the exact same lessons for kids who love the arts or love music or love drama.
Right, right. There are a lot of, and you talk about this in some detail in your book, there are a lot of burdens that parents inadvertently put on their athletic children. And what can be done to change that dynamic? I mean, I would imagine that a lot of those parents have no idea that they're doing anything wrong.
No. Well, some are self-aware, and fortunately or unfortunately, most of the people who seek out my help tend to be self-aware. So sometimes it's a little bit like preaching to the choir, but they're looking for strategies and tools to help make these sport experiences valuable and really something that is going to benefit their children for a lifetime. So I always say, you know, that they're going to learn strategies and they're going to gain coping tools that they can then play forward in life. And much of my work is using the sport experience, but also talking to kids about how those lessons are then transferable to academics or, you know, whatever other performance opportunities they may seek out in the future. In terms of the parents and kind of managing expectations, there has been a big push across the country for using sport as a means to perhaps build resumes for college entry and get scholarships and things along those lines. And I think presenting the data to parents, which is fairly startling in terms of the number of scholarship opportunities available. You know, you're talking really about your top 1% in most sports. There are just so few opportunities. And so I think you really have to help parents understand that the bigger picture is what's important, and to use each and every opportunity and challenge that their child faces to then parent through that in a way that is helping their child emotionally grow and develop a skill set that's going to serve them well for a lifetime.
We're talking to Caroline Silby, author of the book Games Girls Play, Understanding and Guiding Young Female Athletes. looking at the bigger picture, just as you can't have, for example, infinite economic growth, you can't have infinite population growth, you also can't have infinite improvement in athletic performance, at least not without drugs or other probably very harmful inputs. And sometimes, I mean, I've been watching the Olympic summer gymnastics female floor thing since I was a little kid, and they've gotten so much better. And on the one hand, what they've achieved is amazing. But on the other hand, these young girls don't seem quite real anymore. Their bodies aren't going through natural development. They don't seem like they lead balanced lives. How do you think about balance and think about the impossibility of just this, like, you always have to be better and better than the next person?
Yes, and you're talking about the real issue that's out there right now in competitive sports. And I kind of frame it out as the champion and the child, and trying to kind of balance the development of a child, because they're children who, you know, especially in these individual sports, as they're kind of coming up ranks, they're developing as young people, and they're children first and foremost, and yet they're also very gifted and talented in terms of their athletic capabilities. And so they may be training to become champions, but we always have to keep in mind that they're children, and it takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of educating yourself to be able to create that balance for children. And what I advocate to parents is that be their focal point, because you're hiring a coach, and a coach may or may not also be attuned to kind of the needs of the child, but they're going to be very attuned to the needs of the champion. And so it's really important and critical that parents are there to kind of keep the child in mind at all times, and kind of what the needs are of their child as opposed to their champion.
Caroline Silby is author of the book Games Girls Play: Understanding and Guiding Young Female Athletes. She's a sports psychologist, and once again, she will be speaking at the Quinceañera Tea, celebrating the art and leadership program for girls at Suite 15 in the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex on Sunday, the 17th of June at 3 in the afternoon. It's in honor of the O'Keeffe Art and Leadership Program for Girls' 15th anniversary. Caroline, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Father Dimitrios Pappas of St. Elias the Prophet Greek Orthodox Church and Frederica Volpen, and they are here to talk about the Santa Fe Greek Festival, which is happening this coming Friday and Saturday, June 15th and 16th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Welcome. Yes, sis. Kalimera, sis.
So you just said welcome, good morning?
Yeah, welcome, and good morning is Kalimera in Greek, and we're just here to speak about our festival of
now,
this weekend.
You, and we'll speak about the festival in a minute, but you have such an interesting background. You come from a Greek family from Greece.
Correct.
Grew up in Denver and became a priest in the Greek Orthodox Church and have spent a lot of time in Greece. Was that a calling for you?
It was a calling. I was about 8 years old when I decided to become a Greek Orthodox priest. I was at my grandparents' house doing a service they do at home called the Holy Unction, and the priest called upon me and so forth and said, would you like to be an altar boy? And since that day, I decided to become a Greek Orthodox priest.
What was it that pulled you in? Is there something you can put your finger on that happened that day? You just knew?
I just knew. I just had a calling, I believe. I think everyone has a calling, and some are chosen to become priests and other leaders and so forth in the church and so forth. And that day, the priest invited me to become an altar boy, and so I decided to become a Greek Orthodox priest.
And how did it go from there?
My parents supported me very much and so forth, and from a little boy, I was walking to church because I'd lived about half an hour walking distance from the church. It took me about half an hour. So I was going through all the services. I didn't miss one service. And from there, my parents also supported me because my last name is also Papa Dimitropoulos. It's not Pappas. It's short in here in America. but it is Papa Dimitropoulos, which means Father Dimitri, the son of a priest from the city of Tripoli.
All right. Now, it must have been so interesting for your parents, who were immigrants from Greece, to see their son basically returning to their culture or embracing their culture when so many immigrants' children just go off in the American direction and reject everything.
True, that's true. Yeah, correct, yeah. So, but my parents worked very hard in the restaurant business. They had a restaurant for about 20, 25 years. And so they wanted us to choose other fields and professions and so forth. They didn't want us to go into a restaurant business like
right.
they did.
It was a traditional kind of Greek restaurant that so many of us know.
Correct, yeah, yeah.
So you, Frederica, were born and raised in Greece.
Yes, up to age 15.
Up to age 15 and ended up, after a long life, here in Santa Fe.
That's correct.
And are you organizing this Greek, one of the organizers of this Greek festival?
No, actually, I'm not organizing. I'm the president of the Paris Council.
Ah, okay. So what happens at a Greek festival? Let me guess, food.
Lots of food. Dancing. Children playing. Actually, the dance is the most important thing that's happening. Getting to mingle with the other members of the community, I think it's very exciting. Also for us to share a way of life, our food, more importantly.
Now the dancing, the Greek dancing, is that something, in other words, this is a festival for the whole community, not just for the Greek community, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
That's correct.
So are you going to teach people to do your dances?
I believe Father would do a session.
Is that right?
He loves to dance. One of my passions is teaching the Greek folk dances, and I used to do it in other communities. I've been here in America also. One of them was Seattle, Washington. I was serving there for almost 4 years. And in the West Coast, there's a dance competition every year. It's called FDF, Folk Dance Festival. And I used to teach the dance groups and so forth, and also do symposiums, bringing people from Greece and teaching us the folk dances from Greece. And I also have done some dance lessons here at St. John College, and I will be doing it on Saturday afternoon at the Greek Festival at 4:30 to 5 to teach a few dances and so forth.
On Saturday?
On Saturday, yeah.
Now, what are the characteristics of the kind of folk dancing that you're teaching? Is it circle dances or line dances or partner dances? Or?
Well, it depends on what region you're teaching and so forth. But most of them are in circles, and they hold hands and celebrate of unity, together dancing in a circle.
You said that you did a little bit of teaching at St. John's, and of course, so much of the St. John's Western curriculum is based on the thinking of the Greeks. Have you made a connection with sort of modern Greek traditions and the ancient Greek?
Right now I'm just teaching, you know, the modern folk dances and so forth, but
yeah.
I also explain to them how the way of life also, and the traditions and customs of those dances, of those areas.
What are some of those traditions and customs?
Well, like on May 21st in the northern part of Greece, there is a dance called St. Constantine and Helen. It was dance on fire, on coals.
Oh.
So it goes back to the Dionysian times. So I try to teach them the why and the reason and so forth, and how it came into today, and it's still taking place in parts of Greece, in the northern part of Greece.
Have you danced on coals?
No, I have not.
Not yet.
Not yet. But I will show a video of that at the festival, so people will see how they do that dance.
Tell us a little bit more about the Greek Orthodox religion. How is it like religions that we might know, such as Catholicism or other religions, and how is it different?
Well, the church started, in the early church after the day of Pentecost Day. The Holy Spirit came upon the apostles, and they went out to mission Christ and so forth. So they went through all the way to Greece and to Rome and so forth. The church then split in 1054. So we have the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And we have, back then, it was five headquarters, Constantinople, Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, and Rome. And Rome broke off at 1054, and that's why we have the Western Church and the Eastern Church today. Our church is still the original. It's based, again, orthodoxy means original, the true church. And so we have kept the same way of doing things from the beginning.
And what are some of the basic beliefs of the Greek Orthodox religion?
We have the same sacraments as the Catholic Church, the seven sacraments. But there are four mandatory ones that are important to the Orthodox Church, which is baptism, chrismation, Holy Eucharist, and then Holy Confession. And then the other three sacraments are marriage, Holy Priesthood, and Holy Unction. So basically, you know, the church changed, the Western Church changed things slightly, the way they do their cross, the how they use the Eucharist, many other things that are also.
Do you see your role as primarily ceremonial and performing these sacraments and so on, or do you also have a position being sort of a counselor and person who people come to within the church? How does that work?
I'm also a spiritual leader into the Orthodox Church. They come for Holy Confession, which is like a spiritual psychological council that comes and so forth.
Right, just like Catholic Confession or similar to.
Uh-huh. So they come and get advice, and I try to guide them to spirituality, to their spiritual life.
But the distinct differences, really, from us, the Catholicism, it's the Pope. We do not have a Pope.
Right.
I think that's the very distinctive differences.
And so not having a Pope, I mean, from the Vatican, there's all sorts of, you can do this, but you can't do that. How do you handle that? For example, birth control, that's just eternally disputed situation in the Catholic Church.
Well, we have hierarchs and bishops and archbishops and patriarch that meet regularly and decide, you know, for the churches and stuff like that. So now our patriarchate is in Constantinople, which is Istanbul, Turkey today, and that's where he resides.
And so I take it there's at this point in history no female priests in
no female priests yet, no.
Not yet.
Not yet. No. But I don't...
Never.
Well, in the early church, they did have deaconess that helped out through the service, but they're not allowed to be in the back of the altar.
Right.
And so forth. But they did help out and do other ministry work in the church.
And the other distinctive differences between our church and the Catholic Church is our altar is behind doors. It's behind. You also believe the Catholic, the altar is open, Father.
Yeah, and also the iconography. You know, as if someone comes enters the Orthodox Church, they'll see icons in the church.
Right.
And then that's what's so beautiful about our church also here in Santa Fe is that we have a viewing of iconography. You can come and visit the icons on Thursdays from 11 to 1. And it's a husband and wife from Athens, Greece, who has done the work, Maria and Nico. And we are still continuing to do all the walls of our church needs to be completed. So we're doing some fundraisers. And, you know, doing one of our fundraisers is the Greek festival.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So back to the Greek festival.
Okay.
Dancing. Food.
Food. Well, actually, we are fortunate enough to have a number of the Greek restaurateurs here that they're going to prepare the different type of foods. And we have the South Plaza Cafe that we do souvlaki and traditional type of dishes. The Plaza Cafe downtown that we do gyros.
What are some of your favorite Greek dishes?
Personally, everything. love the cheeses, the lamb,
panakopita, dolmades.
Right.
And then we also have pastries too that are very, really delicious. And we worked very hard on making them. Our ladies of our church does them, and
Father does quite a bit of that. Come on, don't be shy. Like we have baklava, which is with the honey.
I think that's my favorite food of all time.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. We have kurulakia, which is. That's really delicious as well and different. Kurabiedes, that's with the white powder sugar that they melt in your mouth. They're very, very delicious.
There's a very traditional type of cookie that is done in Christmas and also for weddings. It's
but
a wedding
you're doing
cookie.
It, you're doing it here just so that people can get a taste of it.
Correct, yes.
And we're doing melon macarona, which is really very delicious because you have to dip them in honey, and then you put walnuts on the top of everything else. No, they're fantastic.
So all of this is happening on Friday and Saturday, the 15th and 16th of June at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. Now, that's a big space. Are there a lot of Greeks in Santa Fe? Do we have a significant Greek community?
Well, at the church, there's about 40 people, 40 members in our church and so forth. As you know, many Greek people have restaurants here in town, but they're not Greek restaurants, but they're Mexican, you know, type of restaurant, New Mexican style restaurants here.
We're going to have lucumades, which that's, they make them very fresh and you get very sweet with honey and stuff. And also we're going to have Greek coffee.
Ah, how is Greek coffee? What's Greek coffee like?
It's like Turkish coffee. It's very,
very thick. Very
like,
sweet.
Like an espresso type thing.
Oh, okay.
It's like a Turkish coffee. It's very thick and very tasty. It's a little bit better than espresso, I would say.
You're talking to an Italian.
Let's not fight about that. We're going to have some Greek beer and Greek wines.
Excellent. Well, anything else that you want to let us know? Of course, there's going to be music, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Live music. A band from Albuquerque, the Aegean Sounds.
Nice.
And they've been with us for a while, performing at the Greek festivals. And we also have the Palamaika dancers, who will be doing the traditional folk dances of Greece from Albuquerque.
And also we're going to have an agora, which in Greek means a marketplace. We will feature some icons and Greek delicacies and Mid-Eastern delicacies just to be inclusive to our community.
Well, it's wonderful to hear about it and wonderful to have you on the air. Father Dimitrios Pappas, also known as Father Dimitrios Papa Dimitropoulos.
Papa Dimitropoulos, correct.
Very good. Excellent.
Of the St. Elias the Prophet Greek Orthodox Church and Frederica Vopan. Thank you very much for being with us. And for more information, you can just Google Santa Fe Greek Festival and you will find out more about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Ron Bloomberg. He is co-director of the play Other People's Money, which is opening on June 14th at 8 in the evening. And actually, that's tonight. And that's the sneak preview. And then there's a gala reception tomorrow evening, and it goes through the 1st of July. And Debriana Mancini, who is an actor in this play and also one of KSFR's own news staff, welcome to the Radio Cafe. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Shaw. Thanks for inviting us, you know.
It's always good to have you.
Well, you know, years ago they wouldn't let me in here, but she arranged it. I'm delighted.
What, because you weren't on a leash?
Yes.
We've trained him since.
So this play, Other People's Money by Jerry Sterner, is from, what, over 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. And it's as current as it could possibly be. What's it about?
Well, this is a play that I would read religiously every year because I love the dialogue. It's smart. It's very sophisticated. It has something to say. And it's about a character called Larry the Liquidator, one of the great characters in theater. It's a wonderful role for an actor.
Yeah.
And he is a vulture capitalist. He's a equity private equity firm he has. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't exactly equate it with Romney, but Romney has Bain Capital, so this kind of makes this very current, you know. These are firms that take over companies and sell off assets and fire the people and somehow walk away with $12 million. So it's a story that has to do with a owner of a wire and cable company in New England, Jorgensen, who's had it for years, and it's very devoted to his employees and doesn't want to lose the company. But Larry the Liquidator comes in and, by accumulating the stock, tries to get this company from him. So that's the major battle. And Debriana plays a high-powered lawyer, and she is high-powered.
And I'm not sure that was the best.
And she goes right up against Larry the Liquidator.
I do.
This is like a black comedy, only this. It's comedy, it's drama, there's a quirky romance. It's it's really an interesting play.
And there's a lot of relationship issues between my character, Kate, and her mother and this company and Jorgensen, and the struggle between doing what's right by yourself and for so many people. We tend to forget, and this play reminded me, actually, that shareholders are people, too. There are so many people involved, and we tend to label people like, you know, giving people the name of aliens, for instance, instead of calling them immigrants. When you label people certain things, you tend to forget their humanity is involved. And what I enjoy so much about this play is that it opens a dialogue about both sides or all sides of an issue. There are many sides. This is complicated stuff that we're going through as a country, and obviously still going through. This is, you know, was written, as Ron said, many years ago.
Well, it was the late 80s when it came on, and it won the best off-Broadway play of the year, and then it was later made into a movie many people saw with Gregory Peck and Danny DeVito. So, but I think the play is much stronger than the movie. And I think the people here in Santa Fe who come to see this are going to see a very special production, very special. Not only is it timely, but for the fates have intervened, and we've got a cast that is incredible.
What do you mean the fates have intervened?
Well, I'll tell you one thing about this lady. She just joined us, like, what, 10 days ago?
I think so, yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you kind of read the synopsis, so you know she has a huge part.
Yeah, yeah.
And she, 2 days she had the script, she came in, she was off book on the first act. We couldn't believe it.
This is what amazes me about actors, is you're able not only to act, but to memorize vast amounts of material word for word.
Yeah, yeah, she does it.
I'm not one of those actors, though, that can, like, 6 months from now, I'm probably not going to be able to recite a word of it. It all goes in, it sticks, it's part of the character and who I am during the time frame that I'm portraying it, and then I let it go. And I'm always in awe of people that can, like, spout Shakespeare when they've done it, like, decades later.
Well, our cast
I'm not that.
Is in awe of you, lady,
oh,
I'll tell you,
you
because it was remarkable to see.
Who's playing Larry the Liquidator?
Larry the Liquidator is David McConnell, very fine local actor, really a good actor. The person playing Jorgensen is Michael Davis, and this is an interesting story, I think. Michael Davis is in Albuquerque, and I was led to him by a casting agent, and I called him. Turns out he's in his early 70s, and I said, what's your background, Michael? And he's been in every Broadway musical since 1950, I think, and he worked with, just the top names. And I said to Michael, Let me just tell you, there's very little money, if anything, in this. And you'd have to commute from Albuquerque to Santa Fe, not just performances, but rehearsals. This is not for you. And he said, well, I'd like to come up and meet you, Ron. I said, all right, come up. And he came up and he read, and he loved the role.
He's amazing.
Santa Fe is going to see an actor that they've never seen here. And isn't he really something?
Astonishing.
Now, let's get back to the theme of the play. I think what's so interesting about this is, on some level, it seems like it's one-sided. Like, there have been so many examples of people who come in, do hostile takeovers, as they're called, of companies, mm-hmm. and basically destroy the value that company is producing, in the sense that a company makes product A, and these people come in, sell all the means of production, so to speak, fire all the people, and that product is no longer being made. The value that product had on the market ceases to exist. A lot of people are out of jobs, and everybody else goes home. The very few people go home with some assets and buy fast cars
mm-hmm.
and drive up the price of real estate and things that also don't benefit anybody else. I mean, what's the other side?
Well, This is an interesting play because there are two speeches at the end of this play that are Broadway legends.
Mm-hmm.
Broadway legends are made of these two speeches. If the people come late, if they only see the two speeches, they'll really have an evening of enjoyment
yeah.
because they're powerful speeches. And the first one is Jorgensen, who gets up and gives that side of the story of the company and the employees. And I won't spoil the ending, but there's another side to this.
Yes, there is.
As you're indicating. And
and to me, that is the really compelling reason to see this play.
By the way, I just want to mention the other people in the cast. Michael Davis, Jennifer Graves, David McConnell, Jason Adams. And these are all very good people. And I am co-directing this with Barry Hazen, who's a very fine director.
And what's it like to co-direct?
Well, he's lying in a ditch somewhere now. No. It's, you know something? It's worked out fine. Because when I wanted to pitch this idea to the Playhouse, Santa Fe Playhouse, and see if they bring the play in. And I asked Barry if he had heard of the play. And he said, I love that play. I said, you're co-directing with me. And we have a very, the reason I think it works for us is we see the play in the same light. And so he's done more yeoman work than I have. He's staged it, he's blocked it. I'm more involved in performance of the actors. And this group is so good that I have very little notes to give. So I've really lucked out getting Barry. And it's been a smooth ride.
We're talking about the play Other People's Money by Jerry Sterner. Now, who is Jerry Sterner, the playwright?
Well, he is, of course, the most important person in all of this. Well, the writer is always the most important person in all this.
Spoken like a writer.
But, you know, I've been on your show a lot talking about my plays and plays that I've written. And this is great for me because I can talk about someone else's play. And this is a playwright who I admire immensely. Other People's Money, he was originally a businessman. He did work in the stock market, so he knew the territory very well. And he, at one point, wrote one play before this that got a limited run, and then he struck gold with Other People's Money. Jerry Sterner, unfortunately, passed away in 2001 at a young age of 62. And there's no telling what he could have gone on to write because he certainly has the talent. One of the most interesting things to show you, I guess, a little bit about his personality is I had to read it twice when I read it, but on his grave site, they wrote, finally a plot.
Oh my gosh.
And I was just, you know, wow.
Wow.
It's for a writer.
Is that for real?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Did he ask for that?
I'm sure he did.
That's hilarious.
It's very funny.
It's funny. It's smart.
And it's very
irreverent.
Smart.
All of that.
But this play has a plot.
This play has a plot.
It definitely does.
Of course, yeah.
But it definitely does.
He's being satirical, but, you know. So I would have loved to have met him. I mean,
yeah,
you
I
know,
invited
as a writer,
him to Santa Fe.
Oh, I'd love to have had him.
You know. Now, what do you think makes this play better than the movie?
Well, first, you know the truth? The movie, DeVito was fine. Gregory Peck was fine. The female lead, I thought, was not up to par. Couldn't go face-to-face with Danny DeVito. Didn't have the weight. Didn't have the presence. Debriano, on the other hand.
With Deraine or
you know, and Debriano.
Really?
By the way, getting Debriano, the reason I didn't cast her first is because I thought I'd never be able to get her. You know, she's busy. How many things have you done this year so far? Well,
I worked on a couple of series, one which shall not be named, and Longmire recently. So, you know, I've been auditioning and working a lot this year, and which was another reason why I couldn't even audition because I wasn't here.
Yeah, I tracked her down in L.A. and I said, we need you. We'll give you a trailer. We'll give you a makeup, whatever you want.
Trailer.
Get here. Yes.
He did. It was funny. So, I was actually away when he contacted me, and I was like, oh, my God, okay, can I put my head down and just do this? And I'm really glad that it came up that way for me.
What goes, Debriana, into creating a character like your tough lawyer?
Like my tough lawyer. Well, in creating any character, you have to find, for myself anyway, I have to find threads of commonality, things I can relate to, what are the things that I don't relate to, and then find ways to relate to them so that the person that I'm playing becomes me and I become her. So it's a process. It's a process of, and then the process of integrating the relationships of who I'm involved in and who I may have been involved in that you don't see that come to the fore when I'm confronted with a situation like this one.
Now, do you end up in the play, is there a romantic tension between you and Larry the Liquidator, between your character?
I don't know. I want to really... There could be.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's subtle, but it's there. By the way, I also want to mention the set is beyond belief. Chadney Everett did that, and Skip Rabbit did the lighting. So it's a real professional system we have here.
I think sometimes you can really tell when a play has been made into a movie. I mean, it's not just like I haven't seen the Danny DeVito film, but sometimes, I mean, plays take place in a few spaces, mm-hmm. often indoors, and that doesn't always translate very well into the movie context.
Absolutely right. I mean, of course, on the other hand, that's a big advantage to someone to be able to open it up and to go to different places, you would think. But most often, plays don't transfer well, I don't think, to
Yeah, I don't. I'm trying to think of one offhand that really did, but...
Well, Streetcar.
I was just going to say Streetcar. Yeah. But
because of Brandon.
Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I saw that movie when it came out in the theater, and it leveled me. It crushed me under its heel.
Oh, you know what they did in that movie that they did not do in the play? David Mamet wrote a part for Alec Baldwin to come out in the opening and just, you know, rail at these guys who were sales guys. And they didn't have that in the play.
Well, and I think that's what has to happen. You have to be able to create something different for a film than you do. Than yeah. It's, they're very different mediums, yeah. as we all know.
So well, can I just become a little hustler and say everyone listening to this should go see this play?
Okay, well, the sneak preview is tonight at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
And the gala reception and opening night is tomorrow, Friday, June 15th at 7 o'clock. And the play runs through the 1st of July. It's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 o'clock, Sundays at 2 o'clock. And the number at the Santa Fe Playhouse is 988-4262. A small, wonderful theater, a great place to see plays. Every seat is good. Ron Bloomberg, co-director, Debriana Mancini, Other People's Money. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Sherman.